now have to wait, I said to Mike with a sigh. It is not easy to break off in the middle of an operation, and I sat slumped in my chair, nervous and tense, longing to get on with the operation, hoping that my pathology colleague would report the tumour to be both benign and operable, hoping that the patient would live, hoping that I would be able to tell his wife after the operation that all would be well. After 45 minutes, I could not stand the delay any longer, pushed my chair away from the operating table and leapt out of it to go to the nearest phone, still in my sterile gown and gloves. I rang the path lab and demanded to speak to the pathologist. There was a brief delay, and he came to the phone. "The frozen!" I shouted. "What's happening?" "Ah," said the pathologist, sounding quite imperturbable. "So sorry about the delay. I was in another part of the building." "What the hell is it?" "Yes, well, I'm looking at it now." "Ah, yes. It looks like a straightforward benign pineocytoma." "Wonderful. Thank you." Instantly forgiving him, I went back to the operating table where everybody was waiting. "Let's get on with it." I scrubbed up again and climbed back into my operating chair, settled my elbows on the armrests, and got back to work on the tumour. Each brain tumour is different. Some are as hard as rock, some as soft as jelly. Some are completely dry, some pour with blood. Sometimes to such an extent that the patient can bleed to death during the operation. Some shell out like peas from a pod, others are hopelessly stuck to the brain and its blood vessels. You can never know for certain from a brain scan exactly how a tumour will behave until you start to remove it. This man's tumour was, as surgeons say, cooperative and with a good surgical plane. In other words, it was not stuck to the brain. I slowly cored it out, collapsing the tumour in on itself, away from the surrounding brain. After 3 hours, it looked as though I had got most of it out. Since pineal tumours are so rare, one of my colleagues came into my theatre from his own operating theatre to see how the operation was going. He was probably a little jealous. He peered over my shoulder. "Looks okay." "So far," I said. "Things only go wrong when you're not expecting them," he replied as he turned to go back to his own theatre. The operation continued until I had removed all of the tumour without injuring any of the surrounding vital architecture of the brain. I left Mike to close the wound and walk to the wards. I had only a few inpatients, one of them the young mother I had left paralysed a week earlier. I found her on her own in a side room. When you approach a patient you have damaged, it feels as though there is a force field pushing against you, resisting your attempts to open the door behind which the patient is lying, the handle of which feels as though it were made of lead, pushing you away from the patient's bed, resisting your attempts to raise a hesitant smile. It is hard to know what role to play. The surgeon is now a villain and perpetrator, or at best incompetent, no longer heroic and all-powerful. It is much easier to hurry past the patient without saying anything. I went into the room and sat down in the chair beside her. "How are you?" I asked lamely. She looked at me and grimaced, pointing wordlessly with her good left arm to her paralysed right arm, and then lifting it up to let it fall lifeless onto the bed. "I've seen this happen after surgery before, and the patients got better, although it took months. I really do believe you will get largely better." "I trusted you before the operation," she said. "Why should I trust you now?" I had no immediate reply to this and stared uncomfortably at my feet. "But I believe you," she said after a while, although perhaps only out of pity. I went back to the theatres. The pineal patient had been transferred from the table to a bed and was already awake. He lay with his head on a pillow, looking bleary-eyed, while one of the nurses washed the blood and bone dust left from the operating out of his hair. The anaesthetists and theatre staff were laughing and chatting as they busied themselves around him, rearranging the many tubes and cables attached to him, in preparation for wheeling him around to the ITU. If he had not woken up so well, they would have been working in silence. The nurses were tidying the instruments on the trolleys and stuffing the discarded drapes and cables and tubes into plastic rubbish bags. One of the porters was already mopping the blood off the floor in preparation for the next case. "He's fine," Mike happily shouted to me across the room. I went to find his wife. She was waiting in the corridor outside the ITU, her face rigid with fear and hope as she watched me approach her. "It went as well as we could hope," I said in a formal and matter-of-fact voice, playing the part of a detached and brilliant brain surgeon. But then I could not help but reach out to her, to put my hands on her shoulders, and as she put her hands on mine, and we looked into each other's eyes, and I saw her tears and had to struggle for a moment to control my own, I allowed myself a brief moment of celebration. "I think everything's going to be all right," I said. Chapter 2. Aneurysm. Noun. A morbid dilatation of the wall of a blood vessel, usually an artery. Neurosurgery involves the surgical treatment of patients with diseases and injuries of the brain and spine. These are rare problems, so there are only a small number of neurosurgeons and neurosurgical departments in comparison to other medical specialties. I never saw any neurosurgery as a medical student. We were not allowed into the neurosurgical theatre in the hospital where I trained. It was considered too specialised and arcane for mere students. Once, when walking down the main theatre corridor, I had had a brief view through the small porthole window of the neurosurgical theatre's door of a naked woman, anaesthetised, her head completely shaven, sitting bolt upright on a special operating table. An elderly and immensely tall neurosurgeon, his face hidden by a surgical face mask and a complicated headlight fixed to his head, was standing behind her. With enormous hands, he was painting her bare scalp with dark brown iodine antiseptic. It looked like a scene from a horror film. 3 years later, I found myself in that same neurosurgical operating theatre, watching the younger of the two consultant neurosurgeons who worked in the hospital operating on a woman with a ruptured cerebral aneurysm. I had been qualified as a doctor for 1.5 years by then, and was already disappointed and disillusioned with the thought of a career in medicine. I was working at the time as a senior house officer, or SHO for short, in my teaching hospital's intensive care unit. One of the anaesthetists who worked on the ITU, seeing that I looked a little bored, had suggested that I come down to the operating theatre to help her prepare a patient for a neurosurgical operation. It was unlike any other operation I had seen, which had usually seemed to involve long, bloody incisions and the handling of large and slippery body parts. This operation was done with an operating microscope, through a small opening in the side of the woman's head, using only fine microscopic instruments with which to manipulate her brain's blood vessels.